Father, bless these words to our hearts in Jesus' name. Turn in your Bibles, please, to 2 Corinthians 4. In verse 15, the Word of God says, "For all things are for your sakes, that the abundant grace might through the thanksgiving of many redound to the glory of God." All things are for your sakes. All things are for your sakes. That word sakes is dia. And it means the ground or reason by which something is or is not done. All things are for your sakes. You are the grounds and the reason for which things are done or things are not done. Everything that happens, it says all things. There is not one thing that takes place that is not in some way for your sake. You are the reason why God allowed it to somehow promote you, to prosper you, somehow perhaps to protect you. Things can happen that seem very negative. I can't help but wonder whenever there's an airplane crash, you sometimes hear about people, "I was supposed to be on that plane and then my tickets changed, or I couldn't make it, or I was late and missed the flight or something." People miss their plane. They're not too happy about it. But then if the plane doesn't make it to its destination, then they're grateful. And so their negative circumstance turned around very quickly, very tragically perhaps. But it doesn't have to be tragic. Our circumstances can turn around very quickly. Regardless, though, all things are for our sakes. There's not one thing that is not for our sakes. There is not one thing that takes place that is not in some way for our benefit. Now, there's a reason for this. Not a cause, but a purpose. And the purpose is this: that the abundant grace might through the thanksgiving of many redound to the glory of God. This is why all things happen. Why did that happen to me? This is the reason. It was for your sake. There was a purpose in allowing it to happen. You were the grounds and the reason why it happened. I'm not saying you caused it, but you are the one God had in mind when it took place. It was for your benefit. And the purpose of it was this: that the abundant grace might redound. Now, the word abundant there is pleonazo. It's an aorist active participle. It means it has two meanings: superabundant. Now, it's a participle, so it can be a verb as well, and it is a verb here: to make, to increase. So that grace could be made to increase. That's what it's saying. Now, it's an aorist tense. That means it is continuously happening. What is making grace to increase? It's an active voice. All things that are for your sakes. So what it's saying is that everything that happens to you is there for the purpose of making grace increase. Now, I want to be careful here. In order to understand this correctly, we have to understand what we mean by making grace increase. There's two perspectives, both of them correct, that we look at this from. It's like positional truth and experiential truth. From God's perspective, grace is what it is. It's God's mode of operation. Grace is what it is. It's His throne. It's His kindness being expressed. It's His unmerited divine favor. It is what it is. From that perspective, I cannot increase or diminish grace. I cannot somehow soil grace. I cannot contaminate it in any way. That's the beauty of grace. Grace is perfect regardless of what it comes across. Whatever grace has to deal with, grace is never corrupted by it. Because it's grace. That's the nature of grace. So, when grace increases, it's not that from God's perspective, suddenly He created more grace. as though all the grace that was available, which was an infinite amount because it depends on God and God is infinite, as though I could increase an infinite amount, or for that matter decrease an infinite amount. Can't do it. So from that perspective, grace cannot be increased, decreased, in any way diminished, nothing. However, from a human perspective, from my experience, grace can most definitely increase. Grace can also decrease, but it's not God who would do the decreasing. Grace will only decrease when I fail the grace of God. And then it doesn't decrease in its essence, it only decreases in my experience. I stop experiencing grace because I failed the grace of God. Failing the grace of God simply means I stopped utilizing it. I've stopped turning to it. I've stopped depending on it. I stopped having that as my foundation. But for the person who will turn to grace every time, grace increases every time. This is why David could be who he was. David did not start badly. David started very well. He didn't really start having trouble until his relationship ended with Jonathan. So long as Jonathan was in David's life, David was fine. But when that relationship ended with Jonathan, and that was an iron sharpens iron relationship, that's where his problems really started. Now, every single time that David got in trouble, he would run to grace. David understood grace perhaps better than any other human in history. David understood mercy perhaps better than any other person in history. That's why they're called the sure mercies of David. He would always run to this characteristic that God would always put out there for him. Grace. He knew he was a mess. He knew he was a failure. He knew he was insufficient. He knew he was a train wreck. But he always ran to grace. And grace upheld him every time. In our own lives, big or small doesn't matter, detail doesn't matter, what it is doesn't matter. It can be tremendous success. I worked very hard at whatever and I won the science fair or what have you, I don't know. You understand what I'm saying? Or maybe I fell flat on my face and I committed a terrible sin. It doesn't matter. From this standpoint, I always run to grace. I always run to grace. And grace will always accept me. There's never a time when grace will not accept the believer. Grace will always accept me. Grace will always embrace me. And grace will always reveal to me the love of God. So always run to grace. Something happens in my life, it was for my sake, that the abundant grace through thanksgiving of many may redound. According to Barnes, what this is talking about is that many may have occasion of gratitude for God. Thanksgiving of many, that many may have occasion for gratitude to God. Let me ask you, do you think David, when he killed Uriah, committed adultery with Bathsheba, and God forgave him, do you think he had gratitude to God? I think he did. This is why Jesus said about the woman who was washing his feet with her tears and hair, and the Pharisee judged him for it. And he said to the Pharisee, "She that sinned much loved much." Why? She had gratitude to God. She was forgiven immensely. She found a richness of grace in the face of her frailties, her failures, whatever it may have been. She found a richness of grace, and she had a gratitude to God because she was met with His grace and not with His wrath. We'll never, no believer ever can be, we will never be met with the wrath of God. We will only be met with His grace. The word redound is perisue. It's an aorist active subjunctive. It means to be over and above, to superabound. What does this mean? That if all things are for my sake, then grace will always superabound. The aorist is a timeless tense. That means it will abound and it will continue to abound. And then it will continue to abound. And then it will continue to abound. And then it will continue to abound. And it never stops abounding. In eternity past, when God foreknew us, His grace was abounding. This is why it really wasn't much of a problem in the garden when Adam and Eve failed. This is why God went after them instead of being angry with them. Because grace was always abounding. It was superabundant and it was becoming increasingly superabundant. You can say it was becoming super duper abundant. It was always abounding to the glory of God. That's the thing, to the glory of God. Grace abounds to the glory of God. Do you think that that woman Mary, when she would come to Him and wash His feet, do you think it was to the glory of God? Do you think when Mary Magdalene, who was a prostitute that was possessed by 7 demons, when God delivered her and she stood with Him at the cross, one of just 4 people who stood with Him at the cross, do you think that it was to the glory of God? Do you think what was done in her heart was to the glory of God? Do you think the mercy that God showed her and the deliverance He gave her, was that to the glory of God? The thief on the cross, when he says to Him, Lord, remember me when you enter into the kingdom. And then Jesus says, today you will accompany me into paradise. Do you think that was to the glory of God? That God would be so kind. That God would be so merciful. That the man was being sentenced to death for his crimes. And God Himself says, you will accompany me into paradise today. Is that to the glory of God? I think so. Grace is to the glory of God. Grace is always to the glory of God. In John 1:17, the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth by Jesus Christ. What does this tell me? That the law is different than grace and truth. The law is different than grace and truth. There is no law in grace. There is no standard of evaluation in grace. Is there a standard in grace? Think about it for a moment. Is there a standard in grace? Here's the answer. Grace is the standard. The standard that exists in grace is the heart of God. That is grace's standard. What is the heart of God? If I apply the heart of God, I will apply grace. If I go contrary to the heart of God, I cannot apply grace. The heart of God is the standard for grace. And grace is the standard for us. And so, the law came by Moses. Yeah, that was Moses. But grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. Notice something else here. Grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. These are inseparable. There is no truth apart from grace. If there is grace, there is truth. If there is truth, there is grace. Now, this is really referring on one level also to the three dimensions of grace. In other words, we know that in Ephesians 1:7, it is the unmerited divine favor of God. We know in Ephesians 2:7, it is the kindness of God. But we also know in Hebrews 4:16, that is the throne of grace, a government of God. Now, that government of God rules in our hearts. Jeremiah 17:12 says it's a glorious high throne from the beginning. That means from the beginning, the throne of grace was God's throne. It's not like God changes thrones. The throne of grace has always been God's throne. From the beginning, there was a plan of grace. From the beginning, God's command toward us was grace. From the beginning, to be right with God, you had to have a throne of grace in your own heart. And so we understand that truth is found at the throne of God. And that's the throne of grace. The glorious high throne and the truth of Jesus, if you combine them, you get the glorious gospel in 1 Timothy 1:11. It's the glorious gospel. Have you ever considered that even though you may be born again, you still need the gospel? I'm not saying that you necessarily need to hear the plan of salvation over and over again, but you need the gospel. You need it, why? Because it's a gospel of grace. Constantly I'm being delivered in different areas of my life. Constantly I'm being transformed in different areas of my life. Constantly I'm being converted in different areas of my life. Constantly I need to grow in different areas of my life. It's a glorious gospel. What makes it glorious? The same reason why grace is glorious. Because it reflects the nature of God. The full glory of God can only be manifested through grace. Think about it. How could God express who He is if He had no one to express it to? How could God express His love? The first two characteristics are long-suffering patience, which is in practical application mercy, and kindness, which is one of the three dimensions of grace. How could God express those things to those who did not need it? The angels didn't need it. They were perfect. He needed someone who was imperfect. That's why the fall took place. The fall had a purpose on the devil's part, yes, but the fall also had a purpose on God's part. He didn't cause it. He allowed it. And He planned for it. Because He knew exactly what would happen if you allowed the devil in the garden. He knew exactly what would take place if you put the tree of knowledge into the garden. And you know what? He had purpose in it. So that His grace, His mercy, His loving kindness could be revealed to us. In Ephesians 2:7, that in the ages to come, He might show the exceeding riches of His grace and His kindness toward us through Christ Jesus. Exceeding, hyperbolon. Aorist middle subjunctive means to surpass, transcend, excel, or exceed. Now the interesting thing here is the middle voice. The subject produces the action of the verb, and the subject receives the benefit of the verb. So what it's saying, who is the subject? He is the subject. What is the verb? It might show the exceeding riches of grace. Aorist middle subjunctive. God does the revealing of grace, and God receives the glory of grace. Grace has great glory. Grace has immense glory. It builds us, it edifies us, it delivers us, it heals us, it gives us a life, it picks us up, it restores us, it redeems us. But then it says here, the exceeding riches of His grace. It's plentifulness. It's abundance. It's lack of want in His kindness. You realize what this is saying? That God gets glory from being kind. God is kind to us and does it through Christ. And He gets glory from His incredible kindness. He takes someone like King Ahab, most wicked king that ever lived. We think of tyrants that we remember in history, or perhaps we have them in the history books and we can remember what they did through the history books. And we think, what tyrants these are. They're nothing compared to King Ahab. King Ahab was the worst tyrant of all times. But yet, at the end of his life, he humbled himself before God. And he received the mercy of God when he humbled himself. And God spared him. That was kindness. God did not do the things that He said He would do to him out of anger. God gave him His kindness when Ahab humbled himself and turned to God. He's like that with us every time. Except here's the thing, we're born again, we're washed in the blood. He'll always be exceedingly kind to us. Have you ever felt like you made God mad? Maybe you don't say, I never felt like I made God mad. Have you ever felt they wouldn't be happy with you? Have you ever felt, oh God, I blew that one? Have you ever felt, God, I messed up? You know what God says to you? I love you with an everlasting love. And with loving kindness, I will draw you. Israel, backslidden, whoring after idols. And He says, I love you with an everlasting love. And with loving kindness, I will draw you. There's not a believer alive who God doesn't have that as His heart toward. I love you with an everlasting love. And with loving kindness, I will draw you. What is it? Are you afraid of something? Maybe your circumstances, maybe future. Are you afraid of something? Have you had a failure in your life? Maybe you fall into sin. Maybe you're anxious and circumstances are intimidating to you. Maybe people come against you. And God says, I love you with an everlasting love. And with loving kindness, I will draw you. You know why? It's the glory of grace. It's the glory of grace. When God does that, grace increases. It's the glory of grace. Why do you think that God shows grace? It's not His character. He's gracious, but grace is His means of operation, His mode of operation. It's not a characteristic of His character. Why grace? Here's the answer. Grace encompasses the expression of God's full character. And that's why we were created, so that character could be expressed. You all know this scenario. Somebody falls in love with somebody else and they just have to tell them. They can't help themselves, and they may even say to themselves, even if they reject me, I have to tell them. It's exactly where God is. That's grace. The full expression of His character. God just had to tell, had to express the love that He possesses. The love that fills His heart and defines who He is. God had to express it because love is always expressed. And so God created grace and said, this is going to be the means by which I operate. This is going to be my throne. This is going to be where people meet me so that my full character can be expressed. This is why we never have to be afraid in any circumstance. This is why we never have to wonder, will I be met with grace? Of course you will be met with grace. There is nothing else that can meet you. That's the only thing there is God's grace. What about those people who are lost? That's the only place God meets them too, is in grace. And the only reason why anyone is ever lost is because they rejected that grace. They were haters of grace. They were haters of mercy. But it wasn't because the grace wasn't there. It was because they made their own decisions against it. In Romans 5:15, but not as the offense, so also is the free gift. For if through the offense of one many be dead, much more the grace of God and the gift of grace, which is by one man, Jesus Christ, hath abounded unto many. Understand this. The offense is of a certain nature. The free gift is of a different nature. The offense is this. Many people, I'm sure, when they hear that word offense, think sin. It might be sin, might be something else. The offense is this. Romans 14:23. Whatsoever is not of faith is the offense. Whatsoever is not of faith is the offense. This is why we can never be judged. This is why we can never judge. This is why we have no other option but to operate in grace toward ourselves and toward other people. Because whatsoever is not of faith is sin, and God has established the throne of grace. So if I'm going to respond to God in faith, I'm going to be responding to grace in faith. And by that faith, I stand in that grace. And if I decide not to respond by faith to grace, and maybe I'll respond to something else. Maybe I'll respond to, I don't know, negativity or anger or whatever. If I respond in anything but grace, then I'm responding outside of God. So I always apply grace in my thinking. So I always utilize grace as my premise. So I always have grace as my standard. So I always deal with myself according to grace. So I always deal with you according to grace. Because grace is God's expression, and that is the only expression God has ever given to us. It's all grace. What about the flood when the world was destroyed, but Noah was saved? The rest of the world had rejected the mercy of God. They rejected the grace of God. They hated it. But Noah loved it. And Noah responded to it. And Noah and his family were the remaining Christians in their day. And they were saved. Now by that I'm not saying the religious term Christians. By that I mean those people who understood and accepted the redemption of God. And they were saved. Lot accepted the redemption of God. Called the Sodomites his brethren? Yes. Was he a train wreck? Absolutely. Offered them his virgin daughter, said, have your way with them, just don't hurt my guests. Mess of a man. But grace. He was met with grace, and that's all anyone could be met with, is grace. Saul started well for a short time, ended very badly. When he was right with God, he outlawed witchcraft, and then at the end of his life, when he was wrong with God, he went to a witch and asked her to tell him what's going to happen. But you know what? The testimony of David was so beautiful in all his days, beautiful in his life. Not one reference to anything negative. And David, of all people, had reason to turn negative against Saul. I mean, how often did that man throw a spear at him? How often did that man go chasing after him, trying to kill him with an army? And David said he was beautiful. All his life he was beautiful. He called him the Lord's anointed because he recognized that that's what he was. He never used words like backslidden. He never used words like sinner. He never used words like fallen. He never used words like hate, enemy, wrong. He never used anything like that. He never rebuked Saul when he had the opportunity. And the one time he thought about it, he repented. Why? Because David loved grace. David loved grace. Why did David love grace? Because David loved God. And David loved God's expression. David loved grace. And he knew that those words were not in God's vocabulary toward Saul. And he refused to think outside of grace, because he refused to think outside of the heart of God. God will never think apart from His heart toward us. We must never think apart from His heart also. In Romans 5:20, moreover, the law entered that the offense might abound. But where sin abounded, grace did much more abound. And remember sin, Romans 14:23, whatsoever is not of faith. We have to stop thinking in terms of Mosaic law. And I think that ingrained in our thinking, partly because of our culture, or for those who had it because of religious upbringing, we think of sin in terms of Mosaic law. But we have to understand that the Bible defines it as whatsoever is not of faith. Whatsoever is not of faith. So if I'm going to be right with God, I think in grace. I exercise faith toward grace. Now here's the thing. My humanity causes grace to increase. My humanity causes grace to increase. My humanity causes a greater expression of God's character toward me. In 1 Timothy 1:13, Paul said, I obtained mercy in unbelief. I obtained mercy in unbelief. Why? Because where sin abounds, grace does much more abound. I fail and grace increases. And in Romans 6:1, do I fail in order to increase grace? Or do I live carelessly because I know grace increases? And Paul said, certainly not. God forbid. I'm not going to crucify Christ afresh. But here's the thing. The experience that I have with grace in the face of my need is immense. Grace meets me on every side. I fall on my face, but I fall into grace. But how often do we think differently? How often do we think legally? How often do we think in terms of Moses when grace and truth came by Jesus? We always run to grace. Our humanity causes an increase of God's expression. A person fails, God's expression increases. Do you know why? I'll tell you why. The perfect, mighty God knows that I'm flawed. And because I'm flawed, the perfect, mighty God is extraordinarily compassionate toward me because I'm flawed. So when I sin, as far as God goes, I simply express the fact that I'm flawed. And so He increases His character toward me. He increases His expression of loving kindness, of mercy, of gentleness, of goodness. He increases these things toward me. That means that I never have to be guilty, because my humanity increases the glory of God's grace. In Romans 5:18, as by the offense of one judgment came upon all men to condemnation, even so by the righteousness of one the free gift upon all men unto justification of life. I fall and I get a free gift. And I fall again. And what did Jesus say? Forgive again. Grace again. I go and I get grace again in Ephesians 1:6, to the praise of the glory of His grace, wherein He made us accepted in the Beloved, in whom we have redemption through His blood, the forgiveness of sins, according to the riches of His grace. Show me a time when I'm not covered in the blood, and I'll show you a time when grace has ended. But my Bible tells me that the Lamb was slain from the foundation of the world in Revelation 13:8. My Bible tells me in Genesis 2:7 that the words for ground and the words for Adam have the same root, and it means to reveal the blood. That I am there to reveal the blood. How can grace be anything other when the very purpose for which I was created was to reveal the blood? How could God ever be angry with me for my weaknesses or my sins or my failures when my purpose on earth is to reveal the blood? What does that mean? That if I'm weak, I go into the blood and the blood makes me justified as it removes my sins in Revelation 1:5, and it removes them also in Hebrews 8:12 from God's mind, therefore from eternal existence. We reveal the blood. Of course we're going to get grace. We reveal the blood. In John 1:16, of His fullness we have grace for grace. The word there, grace for grace. Karin antikaritos. Robertson says, here the picture is grace taking the place of grace. Like manna fresh each morning, new grace for the new day and the new service. Have you ever heard that God's mercies are new every morning? Do you know what that means? Every moment, not morning, not the daytime, not the sunrise, but the beginning of every moment. The mercies of God are fresh. The beginning of every moment, God replaces it with a new portion of grace. How can we help but be followed by grace while we are alive? There's nothing else. We increase grace. It's us that does it. It's an active voice there in John 1:16. It's us that does it. We increase grace. Now here's the other thing. In the grace of God, there's a divine serendipity. Some people are there scratching their head. What does serendipity mean? The definition is, if you look in the dictionary, it'll tell you something to this effect. Accidental events that produce benefit. That somehow things accidentally happened and I profited, I gained from them. They benefited, they blessed me. From our perspective, there's a divine serendipity. In 2 Corinthians 9:8, God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that you always, having all sufficiency in all things, may abound unto good work. Really? You think so? Really? Then tell me about Joseph. How is it that Joseph can be thrown into a pit? And how can you call that good? How is it that Joseph can be lied against by Potiphar's wife and be thrown into jail for several years? And how is it that you can call that good? And the reason is very simple. Joseph never saw it coming. Joseph was in jail. Joseph was in the pit, and he gets taken by the Ishmaelites and gets sold into Egypt into slavery, and Potiphar buys him out of slavery, and the young man is brilliant, and Potiphar makes him the head of his whole household. And I bet at that point Joseph said, wow, there's serendipity. Divine serendipity. But then things go wrong again. And Potiphar's wife starts being aggressive toward her initiations to Joseph because she's an unclean woman who wants a sexual relationship with him. And Joseph said, forget it. And she accuses Joseph falsely to Potiphar, and Potiphar casts him in jail. And do you call that serendipity? You call that a benefit? I'm sure it was unforeseen. I'm sure he had no idea at the beginning of the day what would happen at the end of the day. He ends up in jail and he's there for years. And these two guys, he meets them in jail. One's a baker and one's a butler. And he says, And they say to him, we had a dream, and he tells them what their dream was. And he says to the butler, remember me to Pharaoh. Remember me to Pharaoh. And does he remember him? No. Several more years go by. And finally he's handing Pharaoh the cup, and he says, oh, Pharaoh's talking about a dream. He says, oh, I remember this guy I met in jail like eons ago. I wonder if he's still alive. If he's alive, he might be able to help you out. One day. Didn't expect it, I'm sure. But one day, Joseph gets a knock on the prison door. Guard says, Pharaoh would like to speak to you. Can you imagine hearing that? Pharaoh would like to speak to you. He's in jail. Pharaoh would like to speak to you. I wonder if Joseph said to the guy, are you serious? Is this some kind of joke? Are you like, it's just like you have a strange, is it April Fool's? Pharaoh would like to speak to you. I bet he didn't see that one coming. Divine serendipity. But eventually Joseph learns it wasn't serendipity. And he says to his brothers, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good, so that many may be saved alive. God meant it for good. See, this is the operation of grace. It's like Moses. He's another one. 40 years, he grows up as Pharaoh's grandson, kills an Egyptian, runs away into the desert to hide from Pharaoh, because that's illegal. He's in some serious trouble. He's afraid he's going to be killed. Runs into the desert. 40 years in the desert. Do you think there's ever been a time, Moses was 58 years old in the desert, 18 years in the desert now since he was the grandson of Pharaoh, living in the palace, living in very high esteem, comfort, luxury, what have you. 58 years old, 18 years in the backside of the desert. You ever think Moses said to himself, man, I blew it. Why did I ever touch that Egyptian? Man, I blew it. Year 25, man, I blew it. 37 years in the backside of the desert. He's now 77 years old. Man, I blew it. Probably going to die soon. I mean, you're 77, how much time do you expect to have? Maybe you have a decade or two left if you're very fortunate. But really, all of a sudden, 40 years later, 80 years old, God says, Moses. Moses. Divine serendipity. Moses, you've been being prepared. I got a plan for your life, Moses. You're being prepared. You see, in order to do what you're going to do, you have to be the meekest man who's ever lived, because you're going to come and lead one of the most unruly mobs that has ever lived. Israelites were a tough group to deal with. 603,000 men. And then probably somewhere between 2 and 3 million people altogether, and very unruly. Moses had to be a very meek man. He said, Moses, I've been preparing you. You thought you blew it, Moses, but in truth, I've been preparing you. See, there's a divine serendipity. Moses, you didn't see it coming, but it was my plan all along. See, that's the glory of grace. That God takes our situations, God takes our lives, and He orders our steps in Psalm 37:23. And He takes our situations and He turns the curses into blessings. He takes our situations in Romans 8:28, and He works all things together for good. All of them. How can this possibly be good? I don't get it. That's because there's divine serendipity, but not from God's perspective, only from yours. There is no serendipity from God's. There's only a plan of God where all things are for your sakes. All of them. All things are for your sakes. To us, it only looks like serendipity. All things are for your sake. Richard Warmbrand, jail, 14 years. Tortured in communist prisons just because he won't deny Christ. 14 years, brutal beatings. Can you imagine what must have been the low points of his life, perhaps? And then one day, he's out. One day, he's just released. They say, Warmbrand, you're out. Divine serendipity. Who has done more to reveal the plight of the martyrs? Who has done more to reveal the plight of the persecuted Christians in the world? Who has done more to reveal the suffering that Christians undergo at the hands of the God-haters? Who has done more? See, divine serendipity. I'm sure he didn't see it coming. What would become, what a ministry he would possess. Internationally, winning souls, ministering to the Christians who are suffering, making sure that they are not forgotten about. The serendipity. But it was God's plan. It was grace. It was pure grace. All things are for your sakes. All of them. It's to the glory of God that they be for your sakes. It's for the glory of grace, so that God can fully express who He is. His grace. In 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 7, therefore, as you abound in everything, in faith and utterance and knowledge and in all diligence, and in your love to us, see that you abound in this grace also. Abound in it. Abound in it. Make it superabundant in your own life, in your own thinking. Have grace in your life. Be huge. Because when grace is huge, all your problems, your conditions, the things that you have to deal with, those become trivial when grace abounds. You may have love, you may have faith, you may have utterance and knowledge and diligence, but abound in grace. Abound in it. Because as you do, you increase grace in your own experience and in your expression, and then God is glorified through grace. That's what it means, to the glory of grace. And God's full nature is glorified, and you do the glorifying. Amen.